It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Lots to come this hour. We'll talk with an Iowan who was on the White House lawn in just a few minutes yesterday and heard Pope Francis speak. We'll talk about him with him about what motivated him to go to the White House to hear that speech. But first, the big news buzz, the political news that has the country abuzz today. Embattled U.S. House Speaker John Boehner announced he will retire at the end of October. This ends a tumultuous five-year tenure atop the House of Representatives. Joining us with his thoughts and analysis, Hans Hassel, Assistant Professor of Politics at Cornell College. Hello, Hans.
Hello. Good to be here.
Well, what's your reaction to the news this morning? What do you think prompted it?
Well, I mean, it's definitely a surprise. I mean, most of the conversation in political science circles that I'd seen about the possibility of Boehner being ousted had pointed out fairly clearly that any attempt by the conservative factions within the Republican Party was probably going to be pointless because they were going to end up with some other, more moderate, acceptable Republican speaker anyway. And so I think that this is a surprise that this gained enough traction for Boehner to say, okay, I'm done. I've moved on. This is not a job that I want anymore, or this is a job that I can't do viably, or I'm going to have a poor reputation at the end of this. But whatever the reason, right, he appears to have kind of folded to that pressure. And it was very much a surprise because it's not something that I think most people would have expected, just because it didn't seem like a viable path to removing him for that conservative faction within the Republican Party.
Before we talk about what might come next, Hans, I want you to explain, so we're reminded of the environment that John Boehner has been working in the past 5 years. Let's listen to some interesting audio this morning that we have. Conservative voters roaring in a standing ovation this morning at the Values Voter Summit. This is happening in Washington, D.C. this morning after Senator Marco Rubio of Florida announced that John Boehner plans to retire. Listen to this.
Just a few minutes ago, Speaker Boehner announced that he will be resigning.
Yeah!
And with all due respect to people that serve in government, it is important at this moment, with respect to him and the service that he's provided to our country. It's not about him or anybody else, and I'm not here today to bash anyone. But the time has come to turn the page. The time has come to turn the page and allow a new generation of leadership in this country.
Okay, members of his own party, Hans Hassel, explain to us what's behind those roars of approval. What has John Boehner been fighting in his own caucus?
Well, I mean, I think that this is a perception among a party that controls the House and the Senate that their leadership should be able to do more. One of my friends, one of my colleagues remarked recently that we really shouldn't call it the Speaker of the House as the leadership position. We should call it the leader in charge of explaining the separation of powers, right? This is we have this perception that if we control the House, we should be able to do anything, that Boehner's just not working hard enough, that he's effectively caving to President Obama. And I think that perception arises from divided government. You look at past public opinion approval of House speakers, and in times of divided government, the members of the speaker's own party evaluate the speaker at lower levels. And that stems from this perception that the speaker should be able to do more, and they can't. Right? The speaker is a limited position. He has a lot of control within the House of Representatives, but right, he has no control over the Senate, and the Senate is the place where most things go to die. Right? He doesn't control they don't control the presidency, and so right, if President Obama issues a veto, and the House can't doesn't have a veto-proof majority there to overrule that, and so. I think that divided government frustrates people in the majority in the House because they perceive their party as losing when they think that they should be winning. When in reality, right, we live in a governmental system where we have checks and balances. We have divided government. We have different branches of government which are designed to slow down the process and make sure that one group doesn't get overwhelmingly log rolled and something that they don't want.
Mm-hmm. John Boehner announcing he'll retire from Congress, not just from the speakership, but from Congress by the end of next month. Let's talk about who might take over for him and the battle that it might take to get to find that leader.
Yeah, so, I mean, the names that have been floating around, the main name right now has been Kevin McCarthy, who's a Republican from California. He was someone that was close to Boehner, but at the same time, he was also a key creator of the Republicans' Young Guns program, which is this program that started right before the 2010 election. Was responsible for recruiting a lot of these Tea Party candidates, these members of the Freedom Caucus within the Republican Party. And so I think that he has this ability to bridge those two factions, and I think that that's why he's attractive. I don't think that, I mean, the Freedom Caucus wants someone even more extreme. I don't think they're going to be able to get that, right, because there's only 42 of them, and that does not make up a majority of the Republican Caucus. So you're going to have somebody that appeals to both the moderates in the Republican Party and those more conservative.
Do you expect it, though? Will it be another person who faces the same dynamics as John Boehner, or could possibly a new speaker change the dynamics in the House?
I mean, this is not going to go away. I mean, you've got factions within the Republican Party. You still have going to have divided government for at least another year, maybe more, right, depending on the outcome of the presidential election. This is a situation where I think that conservative Republicans are going to continue to feel frustrated with the party leadership, no matter who's in charge. Mm-hmm. McCarthy may be able to bridge and may be able to persuade some of them to dial it back a little bit. That's maybe something about personalities. But in terms of the institutional dynamics, which are really the thrust behind this conflict, those aren't going to go away anytime soon.
Okay. You mentioned it briefly, but to give us your thoughts on the perspectives from the Senate, the other chamber, and then the White House. Let's start with the White House. President Obama, a Democrat, can he take advantage of this, I don't know if chaos or this upheaval in the House.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure that this changes a whole lot. I mean, he's still negotiating with Republicans. I mean, it changes the leadership. But like I said at the beginning of this, right, conservatives within the Republican Party have essentially ousted ousted Boehner had gotten their way with him. But this doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to get anybody better or anybody that's going to be more hardliner is going to have any other institutional bargaining advantages that Boehner didn't already have. And so I'm not sure this changes the dynamic. I mean, you rearrange the deck chairs, but I'm not sure you're not changing the ship that's sailing in the ocean right now. And I'm not sure that that's going to make a whole lot of difference in terms of, right, the negotiations between the White House and the Senate and the House, right? They're still dealing with the same institutional structures and generally with the same, right, the same ideological preferences within those different caucuses. So those things aren't changing. All you're doing is changing who the leader is, and I don't think that doesn't really change the ability to bargain between these different groups.
We were waiting for a news conference where Boehner would speak. He was visibly emotional as he exited a meeting with Republicans surrounded by security guards. He declined to answer questions, canceled that news conference, but said thank you when a reporter congratulated him on his retirement and said, "This is a wonderful day." So I guess we can only speculate why he didn't address the people himself.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think it's probably a situation where, I mean, what are the advantages of addressing addressing individuals? He's not only retiring or resigning as Speaker of the House, but he's also retiring from the House itself in a month. And so I think that he says, well, what's the advantage of creating this relationship with the press at this point? I don't think there's no incentive for him to do that. There may be a strong incentive for him not to not put himself in a situation where he might make a mistake or might make a gaffe or something like that. And so I think he's just saying, right, I don't have an institutional incentive to continue to play this game with the media. I'm going to go my own way and let my actions speak for me rather than take the time to address this, because I don't have to address this to the people. I'm not seeking re-election in the future.
Okay. Thank you very much, Hans Hassel. Plenty more analysis from you and others as this new era in the House will begin after the retirement of Speaker John Boehner, the Republican. speaker from Ohio. Thank you, Hans Hassel, Assistant Professor of Politics at Cornell College.
Well, thank you so much. It's an exciting time.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, a News Buzz edition of our program on Friday. Of course, we like to have quick conversations to touch on some news items that we didn't otherwise get to this week, or to jump on some breaking news, as we did just there with the retirement of Speaker Boehner. A very busy, exciting week in the news. Pope Francis in New York City today, yesterday. Thousands of people anxiously waited for Pope Francis at the White House, cheering, waving miniature flags of the U.S. and Argentina, too. That's the Pope's home country. Here's a few of Pope Francis's remarks on the White House lawn with a nod to America's immigrant tradition.
Mr. President, I'm deeply grateful for your welcome in the name of the all Americans. As the son of an immigrant family, I'm happy to be a guest in this country, which was largely built by such families.
Pope Francis yesterday morning on the White House lawn. Also on the White House lawn, watching those proceedings among thousands of others, Brian Stewart from Iowa City. He heard the Pope speak, was there. Brian, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me, Ben.
So we heard many on the lawn had waited several hours. How did you show up? How early did you show up to see Pope Francis speak?
Yeah, my fiance and I actually were lucky enough to get tickets to see him speak, and we showed up at the White House at about 5 a.m., and he spoke around 9 a.m., so we waited about 4 hours to hear him.
Mm-hmm. Why did you want to see him face-to-face?
Yeah, I mean, I think he is obviously a very important figure in our world as a religious leader and a moral leader for many people, regardless of your faith. I think speaking on such important issues as immigration, as we just heard from that clip, and inequality as well. So for me, it was a really unique opportunity to be able to see him in person and hear what he felt obligated to tell the American people, American Catholics, and the message that he wanted to deliver.
Mm-hmm. Brian, are you a Catholic?
I was raised Catholic, yes.
Mm-hmm. So I wonder if this Pope has made a difference in the way you feel about the Catholic faith and your relation to it.
Sure. I mean, I think like a lot of Catholics, there's certainly areas within the Catholic Church where folks would like to see more done to create a more inclusive and accepting church. I think this Pope in particular is talking about things in a way that speaks to people that maybe other popes haven't quite as much, particularly looking at immigration as a good example of that, and the message he delivered about welcoming refugees and looking at refugees and immigrants as people and with compassion. I think he's talking about things like inequality and poverty and hunger. He's talking about things like climate change, you know, quite frankly, that we haven't really heard that sort of message being delivered from the Catholic Church. And he said some things, you know, sort of not really explicitly, but he said some implicit things, too, that I think give a lot of people hope. That the church is moving in the right direction on a lot of these social issues.
Mm-hmm. As you looked around in the crowd there on the White House lawn yesterday, any moments that will especially stand out for you? Perhaps not only the Pope speaking, but someone you ran into a conversation you exchanged with someone?
Sure. I mean, I think we encountered people on the White House lawn who had traveled from all corners of the country to be able to see the Pope speak. And I think the immigration moment will really stand out to me as a moment that seemed to get the most applause, seemed to really energize people, really sort of touched people's hearts to hear him talk about our nation being a country built on immigrant families and the need for continued compassion today.
Mm-hmm. You're following the rest of the Pope's visit, I imagine, in New York today. Are you looking forward to anything specific in his couple days remaining?
Yeah, I think we've already seen some really interesting things. You know, one thing we haven't noted is he talked about abolishing the death penalty. So issues like that, I think we're continuing to, and I'm in particular continuing to listen to what he has to say, particularly in some of these public masses like the one he'll be doing in Philadelphia this weekend. to see what he has to say in terms of moral guidance for people across the country.
Okay, Brian Stewart from Iowa City heard Pope Francis firsthand speak at the White House yesterday morning. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations in the news to end our week. A rural Iowa lawmaker plans to look to the legislature here in Iowa to stop a lawsuit filed by the Des Moines Water Works against three northwestern Iowa counties. Now, we've been reporting on this Water Works lawsuit. It claims that three northwest Iowa drainage districts are violating the Safe Drinking Water Act. That's a federal act. And the utility claims that drainage tiles in these counties act as a conduit, moving fertilizer from farm fields to Iowa waterways, contributing to high nitrate levels in the Raccoon River. And officials with the utility say it needs up to $183 million to update its system to treat the water for these nitrates for its 500,000 customers. Republican State Senator Randy Feenstra from Hall wants to stop that lawsuit. He joins us now. Senator Feenstra, welcome to the program.
Hey, great to be with you, Ben. I appreciate being on today.
In the moment, I want to ask you how, but first let's talk about the why. Why stop this lawsuit? Why not let the courts interpret this and come out with their judgment? It's underway right now.
Well, being from the background of working together and with community, I think that we first have to look toward what we can do in a positive way working together. And a lawsuit should always be the last step or last alternative. And I don't think good dialogue or discussion has ever been handled on the issue. And probably more importantly, the true studies of where nitrates are occurring and where they're coming from has really never been done. So I guess I'm promoting two things. That, hey, I think we got to put the lawsuit aside and then, number two, study the issue.
Mm-hmm. Now, is that really a question? Because we have a lot of nitrates in our water system. We are putting those nutrients in our farm fields. Doesn't it make sense that they come from the farm fields, even though you can't get a single point source, somebody dumping nitrates into the river, for instance? These are a lot of different fields draining into ditches that eventually make it into our streams and ponds. Doesn't that make sense? Do you really believe we need more studies on this?
Ben, and that's a great assumption. I mean, and that's what everybody just assumes and believes. However, if you think of the largest county in Iowa that has the most cattle, most hogs, most poultry, it's Sioux County. And yet the shallow wells in Sioux County, the wells that are pulling water from close to rivers and creeks and so forth, have very little nitrates in them. I mean, we're running nitrates from one part to five parts to seven parts per million. The high point from the DNR says 10 parts per million is allowed, and anything less than that is okay. So it really begs the question is, why in Northwest Iowa don't we have the nitrates that everybody is looking at around the state?
Where could these nitrates be coming from, if not from farm fields or perhaps from our beautiful lawns that we like to treat with chemicals?
Nitrates always exist, and they always will exist. I mean, nitrates really come from the breakdown of organic matter. It comes from the roots, of, whether it be from grass or corn or beans, the roots dying. And even in our rivers and creeks, there is natural nitrogen that comes out of the base, the bottom of the rivers and creeks. So you'll never, ever get away from nitrogen. I mean, it's just part of the way our ground is made up. The thing that we need to look at is how are we artificially creating more nitrogen by putting more fertilizer and things on fields. And I think that's a study I want to look at. And more importantly, in Northwest Iowa, we're doing natural things around our waterways to reduce nitrogen from flowing into creeks, and we're also doing it to reduce it in our water sources. So, like, we're ponding water and then having cattails and other sources remove the nitrogen, and then takes very little time, and all of a sudden nitrate is down to 1 to 2 parts per million. So,
in the interest of our time, I wanted to get back to this lawsuit you want to stop through a legislative action. Now to the how question, even if the state legislature were to pass some legislation that said this lawsuit cannot go further, can state law usurp a federal lawsuit? It can't, can it?
Well, again, you have to think through where the power lies. Okay, the cities or the Des Moines Water Works, which is a quasi governmental agency, and the counties, these are subdivisions of the state, and so the state has the ability to limit the powers of subdivisions. In essence, it has the power to say, we do not want you to, or we do not recommend that this lawsuit goes forward. The legislature has the jurisdiction to oversee these things that occur. I mean, we can limit powers,
mm-hmm.
and that's where I would go about it, saying I think there should be limited powers on who should be able to file lawsuits.
Mm-hmm. Have you received some feedback from the Des Moines Water Works? If you would, obviously the director there wants to go ahead with it. He launched it.
Exactly. And it's unfortunate. I mean, people say I'm doing this politically. I'm not doing it politically. I'm trying to help the taxpayers, because obviously litigation, you take something to court, the taxpayers are going to pay. I mean, the taxpayers of Des Moines Water Works or Des Moines, and the taxpayers of the counties are going to pay. I want the Des Moines Water Works CEO to say, hey, I think it's time that we pull back and integrate, look together at ways that we can resolve this problem. And I had the DNR down this past week. We're looking at a study with our regional water areas to look at how nitrates can be pulled out of water. And I'd like him to be a part of it also. Instead of spending the 100 and whatever $50 million on a new system, I think there's natural ways that could be done at a lot cheaper cost.
Okay, back to the lawsuit. The legislative session, of course, won't begin until January. How much support do you feel you have with other lawmakers in the Iowa legislature to approve this legislation, create it, and have it pass?
Well, that remains to be seen. I have talked to a lot of legislators, and they seem very supportive. Again, we have to come at it from the right source. I think we all want to do what's best for the environment. So how do we do that? Do we do it in court through litigation, or do we do it in a positive, proactive way of studying it and then coming up with remedies on how to fix it?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm about. I mean, I'm a organizational theorist. I believe in Mary Parker Follett and what she says about, hey, we have to work together as individuals. We're all in this together, and we can't be separate entities. And I think that's what's occurring here.
It's interesting, because isn't it earlier this year you called, because of this lawsuit, did you call for a boycott of Des Moines over the lawsuit?
I said it tongue-in-cheek. I wanted to raise the tension of the lawsuit, simply saying, hey, this is not a good way government should act.
Okay.
I mean, this is not a way government should present itself.
Okay, so you weren't really calling for a boycott of our capital.
No, I mean, it was a whimsical statement, and I pulled back right away saying, hey, you know what, we got to work together.
Okay. Thanks for the clarification. Republican State Senator Randy Feenstra on the topic trying to stop the lawsuit filed by the Des Moines Water Works that claims that three Northwest Iowa drainage districts are violating the Safe Drinking Water Act. Thank you, Senator Feenstra.
Thank you for having me on your program today, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Stargazers, night owls, space observers, be prepared. It's not happened for over 30 years, and it won't happen again until the year 2033. This Sunday, there will be a supermoon lunar eclipse. It will be viewable here in Iowa, weather permitting, in the evening. Joining us to explain this rare astronomical event, Robert Mutel, professor of astronomy at the University of Iowa. Hello, Robert.
Hi, Ben. How are you?
So explain this phenomenon. What is a supermoon lunar eclipse?
Right. Well, it's really the coincidence of two relatively rare things. One would be what's called a supermoon, which is a moon which is brighter and larger than usual, and that's because the the orbit of the moon really isn't a circle, it's an ellipse. So it's closer and farther depending on where it is in its orbit. So we have a 25% brighter moon. That's the supermoon part. And then the eclipse, of course, is that the Earth is getting between the sun and the moon. So the moon enters the shadow of the Earth, and it goes from really quite bright, the supermoon is really, really quite bright, to blood red, sort of a coppery color is what I would call it, for about an hour and 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm. What gives it that blood red color?
Right. So the shadow of the Earth is modified. The shadow of the Earth is really itself kind of a coppery color because the atmosphere of the Earth filters the sunlight through it. It scatters the blue light, which, of course, means that we see a blue sky during the day, but the remaining colors are reddish, coppery reddish, and that's where the moon enters that shadow and really looks quite spectacularly red.
Mm-hmm. When you say 25% brighter and somewhat larger, will it be noticeably larger and brighter in the sky before that eclipse?
Well, that's a funny thing. I think you'd have to really be paying a lot of attention to realize it is quite a bit brighter than a normal full moon, but of course a full moon is pretty bright itself, and this is really about as bright as it gets. People have the impression, I do too, but I look at a moon rising or setting and it looks really large, and then you think, oh well, it's smaller as it gets up in the sky. Actually, that's not true at all. The size of the moon does not change over the course of one evening, but it does slowly change as the moon goes from its farthest point to its nearest point, which takes several weeks.
Mm-hmm. Do you know why it appears to us as if at the horizon it's larger than when it's at the top of the sky?
Well, you know, as an astronomer, I don't really know. I think a psychologist would tell you that it's really the reference, seeing objects on the horizon with the moon, that makes the brain think it's bigger than it is when it's just floating up, up high in the sky.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've described this very rare event, but there's also, I understand, this eclipse is the fourth and final in the so-called blood moons, a phrase that we've used here. It's become popular to describe the four lunar eclipses that we've had in 2014 and 15. So this is scientifically also a rare thing to have so many lunar eclipses in a short time?
Well, lunar eclipses do come in these cycles, and this has actually been known for a very long time. Lunar and solar eclipses are in the so-called serocycles, which goes all the way back amazingly to the Babylonians in 3000 BC. And so it's possible to predict these series of eclipses. It's a pretty complicated geometry, and the reason is that the orbit of the moon is not in the same plane as the orbit of the planets, the solar system or the ecliptic. And so that plus the elliptical orbit of the moon makes this a somewhat difficult calculation to make. But that's right. So this blood red lunar eclipse, we always get during a lunar eclipse. You always get this change in color, and that's just simply because of the atmosphere of the Earth. The shadow is reddish in color, and when the moon enters that shadow, it is red.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's get to the specifics before we have to say goodbye about how to watch it.
Right.
The forecast looks very good, very decent for Sunday. I don't know if it's the same forecast you've been checking, but I think we could be in the clear, huh?
We could be in the clear, and I would say that no matter where you are, you'll be able to see this. The moon is obviously very bright, but if you really want to get the full effect of that blood red moon, you probably should be away from city lights. So if you're out in the country or you can drive out in the country, that's good. If you want to hear some astronomers talking about it during the eclipse, you're welcome to come up. There's a public viewing night at the top of Van Allen Hall here on campus. And starting at about 7:30, we're going to have, I think, at least three faculty, some graduate students up there, and we'll have some binoculars. We'll be able to, as this eclipse occurs and progresses, we'll be able to talk about it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so give us the times here in Iowa that we should be paying attention to. When will the eclipse start, and when will the moon rise, the eclipse start and end?
Right. So there's going to be the shadow of the Earth has two parts, the sort of a lighter penumbra, which starts about 7 o'clock. Really wouldn't notice that very well, but the Earth, the moon will enter the dark part of the Earth's shadow, the umbra, about 10 after 8. and it will be entirely engulfed in that umbra. In other words, it'll be completely dark red, let's say, about 10 after 15 after 9. That'll last for about 72 minutes, and so by 10:20, 10:30, it'll be coming out again, and then it'll take about another hour to come out.
Okay, so a good long viewing time to
it will be.
To hopefully see it. So where will you be viewing it? I'll be at the Van Allen Hall?
I'll be up at Van Allen Hall, yep. That's right.
Okay. Any other astronomical events of note coming up?
Well, you know, there are always solar eclipses. If you could imagine being on the moon, for example, you'd see the the Earth being eclipsing the sun. We, of course, can't go to the moon, but we can see solar eclipses, and there actually is one coming up, which is going to be in 2017. It's about 2 years from now, and it's in August, and it will be the path of totality for solar eclipse. You have to really be on the right spot on the Earth, unlike a lunar eclipse. And that will actually be just south of St. Louis, so not very far from here.
Okay, so a plan for 2017 at in the summer to be south of St. Louis.
You bet.
Okay, we'll put it in our date book. So Robert Mutel is a professor of astronomy at the University of Iowa. Thanks so much for the information about the supermoon lunar eclipse coming up this Sunday evening.
That's it. Thanks very much, Ben.
And to finish up this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, let's talk about some stories. Stories of bizarre events, items so strange and unusual that we thought they might not be true. They might be true. We grew up with them. The Ripley's Believe It or Not franchise, founded by Robert Ripley, some almost a century old, I believe, back again with a new book, what it calls eye-popping oddities in this new book, some of which have Iowa connections. Joining us for a few minutes to talk about the weird and unbelievable in this new book of Ripley's Believe It or Not, Edward Meyer, Vice President of Exhibits and Archives for Ripley's Believe It or Not. For over 35 years, Edward Meyer has traveled around the world collecting unusual stories and unbelievable artifacts. What a pleasure to have you on our program, Edward.
Well, thank you for having me personally, but more specifically, Ripley's Believe It or Not on the program today. And as you've said in your nice introduction there, it's all about our brand new book, Eye-Popping Oddities.
Mm-hmm. So we're interested. First of all, tell us about some of the Iowa connections here. We have a great ape, a bonobo in Des Moines that's quite talented.
Well, I was going to say, and it is all true, so there is no question there. Chimp Chef, he got an ape named Kanzi, 34-year-old male, part of the Great Ape Trust in Des Moines there, and he is able to get his own barbecue stick, I guess you'd call it, marshmallow stick. Let's just call it a marshmallow stick, and able to make fire, which I think is really, you know, I thought that was one of the things that only man could do. But
right.
Collect sticks, make a fire, and then toast marshmallows on a pointed stick.
Mm-hmm. And
pretty clever ape.
And Charity Nebbe, who has another talk show on our program, Edward, at 10 o'clock here, has actually met Kanzi and says, when I mentioned this to her, said Kanzi is capable of so many other neat things. But let's go from great apes to great eaters in your new book here. We have a very small competitive eater named Molly Schuler. Tell us about her.
She is, in fact, a fairly tiny person. January 3, 2014, accepts a challenge and eats a 72-ounce steak in under 1 hour.
Mm.
Goes on to the state of Nebraska, and in 2 minutes, 44 seconds, gets that steak completed.
Mm-hmm.
January 31, she goes to Philadelphia and eats 363 chicken wings.
363.
And then the very next day, so this is a three-day marathon here. The third day, she's in Des Moines, Iowa, eats 5 pounds of bacon in 3 minutes.
Oh.
So chicken wings, big steak, and bacon. There's a healthy diet.
Right. Then
if
it was me, I'd go to bed. If it was me, I would go to bed after that and just roll in my stomach would be. like yours, I imagine, Edward.
I was just going to say, mine's turning over just thinking of it, but that may be because I haven't had lunch, you know.
Iowa finds its way into Ripley's Believe It or Not latest book with some cold temperatures in Dubuque.
Dubuque, Iowa, 20 below without the wind chill factor, 49 below with the wind chill factor. This was in January of 2014. 49 below is cold enough to freeze a wet T-shirt solid in 1 minute.
I don't
know if somebody actually had it out on their clothesline to time it, but that's the record we're given.
Okay, there's something for a challenge for our listeners to try out for possibly this cold winter. A man in Fairfield who won a silver medal at the Paralympics.
Well, you saved the best to last. This is... I don't know where Fairfield is, so I apologize for that.
It's in southeastern Iowa, a wonderful town.
2012 Paralympics archery contest. Silver medal despite being born without any arms. Uses his left foot to load the arrow and pushes the bow with his right foot. Absolutely amazing. That, of course, is my favorite of the Iowa stories.
Okay, Edward Meyer.
True accomplishment.
Before we say goodbye in a minute or so, tell us about your collection. I understand you've been doing this for 35 years. You've acquired over 20,000 different museum artifacts. Tell us about a couple of those very quickly, if you could.
All right. Well, 37 plus years worth. This is volume 12 of this series of book. Eye-popping Oddities is the title. We find 1,000 new stories, 500 new photos every year. My favorite in this book appears on page 234, black and white photo of a man standing inside of a whale in the thoughts that it's going to cure his rheumatism.
Why would that happen?
It is the most unusual photo I think even we have ever come up with, and and it didn't work. So there's the conclusion.
Oh, surprise there.
In terms of things actually bought, if you look at page 230 in the book, we got a little story and a photo of a guy who collected his fingernail clippings for over 10 years and sent me a very nice paperweight made from acrylic with thousands of fingernails inside.
Oh, boy. You have that on your desk?
I have that on my desk. It's probably buried under paper as opposed
to on top of
paper.
I agree. Bury it, Edward. Thanks for joining us to talk about...
Thanks for having us on.
Ripley's Believe It or Not, the new book, Eye-Popping Oddities. Edward Meyer there, Vice President of Exhibits and Archives for Ripley's Believe It or Not. And this has been a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.